All right, I think we should get started. I'm Pia Renius, for those of you who don't already know me, and excited to be collaborating on this project. Welcome to the latecomers. These terms are under discussion, but it's still the latecomer session. Italy, Spain, Greece, Turkey, and we'll start with Ted Perlmutter from NYU.
Okay, actually, Colombia, but that's close enough.
Oh, sorry.
You got the city right, so that's a good start. So
is this going to... Or you can move the computer over on...
Let's see if this carries. Yeah, that's... Sounds okay. Okay. This is the Italy chapter, the latest of the late cases, unfortunately. And what I want to do is actually, since I discovered my time is a little shorter than I had anticipated, speak very much to sort of just two separate issues, one of which is the refugee crisis, and the other is the debates over naturalization and citizenship. So I'm trying to sort of, you know, thinking of this in a textbook venture, trying to give students a couple of narratives that they can hold on to. And I also want to make arguments in the end about how this sort of ties into or perhaps raises some questions about the gap hypothesis. So I'm going to be speaking primarily to what's been happening in the last decade, and leave to others a chance to sort of go back and look at sort of, and argue about my earlier writings about this. Because in the earlier version of this chapter, I spent a lot of time talking about party centrality, the oscillations between policy differences on the right and the left, and how that made it interesting to think about what an Italian policy agenda actually looked like. And I've always been fond of the sort of the widening gyre vision of Italian politics. So as I said, we're going to be looking at responses to the refugee crisis, and particularly the capacity of the EU to sort of enforce its will on center-left political parties during this latter period, and then sort of look at efforts to reform the EU solely, if I have time to get into that, and talk about the effects of weak parties and political polarization producing this kind of impasse. And the question I'm going to sort of raise at the end is, you know, are these really separate stories? Because when I started thinking about this, I thought one case would be very much impacted by the EU, and that would obviously be refugees, and the debates over naturalization and citizenship and the sort of endless effort to reform this law would primarily be driven by internal concerns, because that's sort of the way the literature looks at this. I'm not so sure. So what I'm going to actually argue, just to sort of anticipate it a bit, is that the failure on the refugee front from the standpoint of the Italians impacted all the policy debates, and it had a sort of a series of political effects as well, none of which worked well for those who favor a more inclusive Italian version of immigration politics. That immigration had not been a particularly salient issue before 2015, 2016. Italians had been less likely to see immigrants as a threat. There was less of a securitization discourse. And you can sort of see a correlation with, although I won't go so far as to make the case for this, the rise of support for right-wing parties. And then at the end, I'll sort of conjecture a bit of policy effects as well. So the context is obviously an economic crisis that started in 2008, in which functionally ended labor migration, but as I said, didn't necessarily undermine support for immigrants. And then you sort of saw this sort of series of independent and then sort of weak left-wing coalition governments, and you can sort of see four of them stretching out sort of over 7 years. Now, I would argue that the heart of the Italian refugee crisis was, to some extent, the challenge, or I would put it here, the bias of the Dublin rules, that the implementation of existing EU asylum rules may overburden southern member states, while the perpetuated ignorance of these rules, I don't know why I say ignoring, risk overburden northern member states. So it's sort of a zero-sum game at a certain level. So there are basically two phases. There's the immediate sort of Arab Spring phase, which has relatively little effect, and I'll sort of skip over that a bit. You had a sort of a previously stable arrangement until the Libyan and the Tunisian government fell, and then you start to see these sort of sea arrivals in two phases, the first in 2011 after Libya and Tunisia, and then a later and more protracted one starting in 2014, or 2013 rather. The Italians had sort of reacted by originally sort of coming up with sort of a Mare Nostrum policy, their own sort of way of handling the sea lane issue, which sort of ended in 2014. You also started to see sort of an openness towards within this context, and most importantly, a rather laissez-faire response towards its Dublin responsibilities. Basically, Italy was not registering migrants with the hope that they would continue on to Northern Europe. And they really obviously didn't want the responsibility for supporting and then allowing refugees to apply for asylum there. The EU then, sort of then stepped in first with its sort of sea patrol and then with the sort of, what's sort of the most important component of this, which is sort of this hot spots and burden sharing. I'll skip over the sea patrol issues. And so in May of 2015, the European Agenda on Migration mandated the creation of these hotspots for the purposes of registration and fingerprinting. And the idea was if you wanted burden sharing, you had to comply with fingerprinting. Now, the hotspots succeeded actually remarkably well in terms of getting all those who were coming into Italy to sign up. So within a year, you almost had 100%. But the burden sharing clearly did not. So the numbers that were supposed to be 160,000 from Greece and Italy never really got much beyond about 1,000 a month. And in the sort of reoperational frame time, only relocated 10,000 folks. So again, to sort of skip over a few things, what's really sort of interesting, and this I sort of took from Virginie Girardon's work, is that you had a moment in 2015 to sort of rethink and to give more considered thought to this. And you clearly continued with the existing policies. And, I think that's one of the issues I think perhaps worth raising when we have the EU panel. And this presented certain challenges to Italy with greater refugee responsibilities, without a compensatory policy, and with public opinion starting to see immigration as being out of control. And you can sort of see this as occurring, as this is happening, you can see declining support for immigration and public opinion shifting in an unfortunate way. You can sort of see, that this the shift in line between those who look at immigration as a good thing and as a bad thing, sort of really doesn't happen until 2015. A very interesting chart, which I don't want to say it's a causal chart, but looks at the relation between the number of asylum requests and support for anti-immigration party shaking, and you can see how clearly that maps. Skip over the sort of stepping out effects of that, and then sort of to jump in quickly to the Ussoli case. While Italian naturalization policy tends to get a bad name in European circles for being sort of relatively inflexible, completely bureaucratic, the numbers actually are not that bad. And you do start to see an increase in this, the sort of that upper column there of residence-based citizenship acquisition. But what you also start to see in this recent period is the sort of increase of numbers of children born to foreign parents who do not necessarily have a clear path. And particularly you start to see this in terms of foreigners born, children in Italy born of foreign parents, and they clearly have no path. So the whole idea is to sort of figure out how to sort that out. And I'm going to sort of be, sort of very quick in sort of going over these issues of the changes in the debates over nationality law. But what you saw was a sort of historic efforts to do this. And when I was actually looking at this the first time, it seemed to be a case in which you could actually get bipartisan agreement. 3 minutes, okay. What happened was that moment basically eroded, and it eroded very quickly. So by 2017, refugee crisis was peaking, as the opinions were turning against immigration, what had appeared to be at least a reasonably viable deal fell apart. And I would argue, and I'll put forth in as polemical a fashion as I can in this short period of time, that one of the reasons for that was that the refugee crisis sort of bled on over into this and undermined conceptions and support for any form of migration reform. So, again, sort of, and what you can sort of see is by the end of, you know, by 2017, or between 2011 and 2017, support for this fell from 71 to 44%, and you got complete political polarization about this again. And in terms of thinking about this in terms of elections, Italians who had been less concerned than this traditional EU population about immigration became much more concerned. And as you can sort of see, it became much more concerned precisely during that latter period. So again, sort of to jump into the, you know, sort of the more speculative and hopefully the part that gets us to think about the gap hypothesis, I mean, my argument is essentially that these out-of-control refugee policies had this sort of negative effect. And I'm here sort of drawing on some of the work of Capano and Teresa, and then also arguing that it undermined, as I said, immigrants in Ussoli, and here you can sort of see Tintori's interesting work on Ussoli. And, you know, basically it was a bad check, right? That the refugee crisis was driven to some extent, and I'm obviously skipping over a lot of Italians' own responsibility for this, by the enforcement of Dublin rules with hotspots and no effective burden sharing. And what I'll end with is actually thinking about this in terms of the refugees themselves and perhaps a return to what one would see as sort of the previous bad old days of Italian politics or of Italian labor migration politics, because Italian labor migration had always been based somewhat on you know, sort of weak quotas and then massive sort of sanatoria, massive re-registrations of folks. And what you start to see, you know, is that, you know, I mean, this had sort of been the pattern. These are sort of estimates of illegal migration. And when you start to get to 757, you know, to these high numbers, you start to see these sort of sanatoria. And what you start to see now is that, you know, that these numbers are going to substantially increase precisely because you have so many people who have been worked into the process and most of the asylum cases get turned down. And you still have a lot in the pipeline. So even if the numbers decline, you're finally starting to examine these cases. And if you're going to have 60 or 70% of those turned down on existing standards, it's even going to get worse if, you know, to the extent to which the new regime, the Conte government, is going to basically cut back into the existing humanitarian standards. So you're going to start to see this kind of, you know, spike upwards into the territory in which I think you really are going to see a much greater, you know, sort of a need to think about what you're going to do with all these people who you can, you know, as was in many ways the case with early Italian immigration labor market policies, people who you can neither legalize nor deport. And, you know, this, of course, then raises the question of, you know, the gap hypothesis, right? So, I mean, this policy, which was meant to be, you know, a Northern European effort at rigore, at rigorous politics, has in many ways exacerbated what I've seen as a lot of negative trends within a sort of Italian politics. And also, as I said, you know, sort of contributed to the undermining of other possible reforms. So the question is, you know, is this just unintended consequences? Is it, you know, is this just, you know, what Matt Gibney goes on in a rather eloquent way about the limits of our capacities to do this? Is this a repeat of what happened in the U.S. in 1965? How do we think about this in terms of a gap hypothesis? So.
Thank you, Ted. Thanks.